Okay, our topic for tonight is the Black Death and the persecutions of Jews as a result of the Black Death, or as Norman mentioned, supposedly as a result of the Black Death, but maybe they have nothing to do with each other. So the bubonic plague, or some other form of plague, was afflicting the world's population, and especially the European population, between 1346 and 1353. It was the most fatal pandemic in human history. It killed between 75 and 200 million people, including about anywhere from 30 to 50% of the population of Europe. It spread from fleas to humans, and then human to human via aerosol. Fleas on the black on the backs of rats that were traveling on ships, Italian ships, Genoese ships, from the Mediterranean basin and from Asia towards European markets. The bacterium was Yersinia pestis, if I pronounced that correctly. And the term quarantine has its origins in the later years of the Black Death. In the 1370s, it came back, not as big a vengeance, but it returned. And in the city of Dubrovnik, there was a 40-day isolation period, which became the term quarantine. Now, England tried unsuccessfully to take measures to stop the spread that were rational as opposed to totally irrational and religiously based. What did they do? They prevented ships from engaging in maritime commerce and stopping at English ports if they were coming from an afflicted region. You know, kind of like stopping people from coming in from China in 2020. So the British did that, or the English did that, with little success, maybe nominal success in stopping the spread to England. But many saw this not as a scientific matter to try to halt by rational means, but rather as a supernatural phenomenon. Well, why? Why see it that way? And if you're going to see it that way, define it further.
They didn't know any better.
Number one, they didn't know any better. Science was not exactly so
Look
far
at us.
advanced.
Look at us today.
Okay, so alternatively, it was a devilish plot by the enemies of society. No, the Chinese Communist Party, that's the current version of that. So depending upon how you want to see things, it's either God's doing, nefarious actors, something we just can't control, something maybe we can control by rational means, all the different shittos that you have in the here and now, you had them back then 700 years ago. Well, what kind of explanations were being offered? The Paris medical faculty reported great pestilence in the air. It was in the miasma theory, bad air or night air, the product of the conjunction of three planets. So something was bad about the quality of the air in the atmosphere, and people were breathing it in, and that was causing harmful effect. Muslims tended to see this through a religious prism, not a scientific one. They saw it as martyrdom of mercy for believers and punishment for non-believer. Well, it's kind of the same thing, actually. I mean, at the end of the day, you're dead. So whether it's a martyrdom of mercy or it's a punishment, sof kol sof, you're in the kever. Christians saw it as punishment for sin. But which sin? So I ask you, which sin are they going to claim it's a punishment for?
Letting Jesus
Killing
die.
Jesus.
Well, if the Jews were the ones dying, then yeah. But since they're the ones dying, what punishment is
Let him
what is the
die.
sin?
They have beat punished for letting him die.
They lived long after he was long gone. But in the here and now, the Christian who is dying in the bubonic plague in 1348, what sin are they being punished for? So the papal authorities and other thinkers in the church offered three possible explanations. One is Christian infighting, that we shouldn't be killing each other. We're religious kinsmen, co-religionists. Why? Well, basically, sine sine. Why should England and France be at war for 100 years? If we're a good Christian and you're a good Christian, why should we kill each other? What's the point? That's one possible sin. The other sin, not prosecuting the Crusades against the Muslims of the Holy Land sufficiently. Now, the truth be told, they did their fair share, but they lost. In other words, how many times are you going to fight the same fight with a bad outcome? There was the First Crusade, the Second Crusade, the Third Crusade. I mean, they tried it, and for a little while had success. The Crusader kingdoms were in place from 1099 to 1187, defeated by Saladin. But, you know, if you're a fundamentalist Christian and a zealot, and you believe that other faith groups have no business controlling the holy places of the Bible, then yeah, sure, you were insufficiently zealous in prosecuting the Crusades. And the third reason, although the popes did not say this, was the sin of tolerating Jews in our midst. Why did we ever allow them to live? Well, we know the answer to that. We've been discussing for the past 3 months already the Augustinian doctrine of allowing Jews to survive but not thrive in Christendom as evidence of testimony to the truths of Christianity and for the prospect of their future conversion. But if you wanted to be really bigoted about it and take an extreme approach, a very aggressive approach, they shouldn't be alive. What are they doing here? The fact that we didn't kill them, we're suffering because we didn't kill them. Okay. So there's always going to be a desire to find a scapegoat. You know, if you don't want to say the punishment is for our own wrongdoing, and by the way, most people don't want to say that. It's a lot more tempting to blame somebody else than to blame your own unrighteousness. So who are the potential targets for the animus of the crowd that's dying of plague? Tell me. Well, aside from Jews. Jews are obvious. We're Jews. It's Jewish history class. But who else? Not the Muslims, because the Muslims tend to not be near the Christians. I mean, other than in medieval Spain where you have border wars. So Christian dissenters was the classic scapegoat of the first millennium of the Common Era. But by the second millennium, Christian dissenters are no longer much of an issue. The church is a very Catholic and Orthodox church without much fringe activity. The only people on the margins are the Jews. So who else might you blame aside from the Jews? The answer is, well, you could blame the friars, who were kind of weird, foreigners, who might also be Christian, but they're foreigners, beggars, pilgrims, lepers, and the Romani. Okay, the gypsies. So these are some of the outcasts of society, and people, Eli, I saw that. Right. You know, people look to blame somebody, and if you're not from this place, even if your religious convictions are supposedly the same as mine, you're only passing through. Well, we don't like the vagabond or the one, in Rambo. They try to arrest Rambo in the first movie. Why, he's wandering through town on the highway, a vagabond. They say he's up to no good. So if we don't know who you are, you must be up to no good. And it's your fault that we're all dying of a plague that we can't understand. And if you really believe that people are dying in large numbers because of the nefarious and sinister action of this other group, then, to borrow a Talmudic phrase, haba lehagecha, hashkem lehago. If guy's coming to kill you, kill him first. So the prospect for genocidal activity in the midst of a very lethal pandemic is quite evident. I mean, if I'm dying and I don't want to die, my whole mishpacha, then I'll kill you. And even if I wasn't a murderer or a killer in an ordinary context, these are extenuating circumstances. And my moral compass will be skewed by the extenuating circumstances. Okay. Well, the Black Death destroyed the moral fabric of Christendom. And this has very little to do with Jewish history per se, but I want to explain to you the environment in which the Jews got killed. That parents were abandoning children. Pastors were abandoning their parishioners, all out of a fear of contagion. You know, kind of like in 2020, where you can't go to a funeral, you can't do this, you can't visit your family member in the nursing home. Okay, you can't get a nursing home. So there, the government imposed restrictions. Back then, there were no government restrictions. It's just the reality that people didn't want to die, and they had no idea how they might get sick but they figured interacting with others is going to get them sick, and so people no longer did the kindness of the ben adam l'chaveru that they used to be accustomed to doing, and which the church, for all of its flaws and for all of its anti-Semitic sins, the church did bring an element of compassion into the world of European barbarism and make them into more of a mention. And I don't know. So this ended all that, and it brought back a barbaric phase in European society. Charity was dead. Christianity was bankrupt. And the veneer of civilization and religion utterly disappeared. So there is a theory that the Jews were seemingly less affected by the Black Death than were the Christians. And this served as the pretext for persecution of the Jews on the premise that, well, why are they dying in lesser numbers? Must be because they know something that we don't know, that they're the guilty party, and they're taking measures to protect themselves from the very, nefarious acts that they're imposing upon us. So that was what people believed back then. Was it true? So before we ask whether it was true, the better question is, did the Jews think it was true? Not that they were well poisoners or anything like that. Not that they were admitting to any averas. But the statistics, the idea that they were suffering less from the pandemic, did Jews accept that premise?
It'd be like the same like today. The real from one who say Hashem sent it, Hashem killing.
Okay, but regardless of the divine aspect of the whole thing, what were the numbers? And did the Jews accept the premise that they were dying in lesser numbers? The answer is yes, they did accept that premise. And for hundreds of years, the scholars also accepted that premise. Whether it was right or wrong, we'll see soon enough. But what was the theory behind acceptance of those numbers, if you put aside all the shtusim of well poisoning and anti-Semitic accusations? How could you try to rationalize disparate numbers without implicating any sin on the part of the Jews? So what are some of the features of Jewish life
Jews that might have led their to hands?
Okay, good. So now we'll go through a whole bunch of Jewish rituals that were seen as contributing to better numbers on the Jewish side of the aisle. Number one, well, altogether it's better hygiene, but number one, ritual hand washing for bread. So, Al Natilas Yadayim, Hamotzi Lecha Min Haaretz. This is not a Torah commandment. In the Torah, there's only one line about Yadav lo shataf b'mayim in reference to Tumah V'Tahara by the Metzora and the Zav, okay, which is not relevant for us anymore. But by rabbinic decree, Yadayim shniyos hein, hands are second degree impurity, and second degree impurity will nullify truma, which is can receive third degree impurity, shlishi l'truma apostle. And so Chazal imposed hand washing for Kohanim for truma. And then because of srach truma, to regularize the Kohanim, they should do it. In that case, they imposed upon all of the Klal Yisrael to wash hands for bread and for tibula b'mashke, dipped vegetables and fruits. Although we don't really do that much other than on the Seder night. We do the without a bracha for karpus. So that's one theory behind why we do Natilas Yadayim for bread. However, there's another theory that appears in Tosfos, and that is Mishum Nikiyut, basic cleanliness, that the Chazal didn't want us eating bread with dirty hands. And, Baruch Hashem, we have Chazal give us these decrees. So that's going to be, we're going to address that point also.
One question. Yeah. What percentage of the population follow these practices? You look around today,
yeah,
a lot of Jews, but very few of them.
Okay, so let's assume for the moment that the hygienic practices of Judaism were widely observed by Jews of that era. So number one, washing of hands for bread. Number two, washing of your hands after you relieve yourself, urinating and defecating. Okay, mikvah observance. And the big one, bathing on a weekly basis for Shabbos. Now today we have showers, people take showers every day. In the old days, they hardly ever bathed at all. However, there's a mitzvah, lirchotz panav, yadav, viraglav, before Shabbos, becham in hot water, your face and your extremities, your arms and your legs. Okay, the average goy didn't bathe at all. Then, chevra kadisha, the tahara of a dead body, taking care of it in that regard, rather than leaving it exposed out in the open, rotting in the presence of a lot of people. Also, a prohibition on tefillah and kriyas shema and Talmud Torah in the presence of what? Excrement. Excrement. There's a whole sugya in Gemara Shabbos about soa and meraglayim. Urine and excrement. You can't daven and you can't learn Torah in a bathroom or in a latrine where it's foul stench. So because Jews are always learning Torah and always davening, you know, so we got to stay away from that stuff. All these things were seen as helping the statistics. The other was that Jews lived in ghettoed areas. And if not legally required to live in a ghettoed area, at least de facto were living amongst their own. So to the extent that better hygiene or whatever the factor was improving the outcome for the individual Jew, it was improving the outcome collectively for the Jews because there was less contagion in their environment. So that's these are some of the theories that were thrown around to explain the numbers. Maybe. Okay, now. Northern France in 1306 and England in 1290 expelled their Jews before the Black Death. So if we're going to talk about where the persecutions were, we're talking mostly Spain and Provence, where there still were Jews, and then the Swiss areas, and then the Germanic lands, and then further north and east eventually. Okay, the first persecution was in Toulon in Provence. 40 Jews were killed. This was in the early part of 1348. The pogroms then extended to Barcelona and the rest of Catalonia. Early 1348, so we're talking Spain and southern France. Late 1348, the Swiss lands. 1349, the Germanic lands. Now, key point. News traveled faster than the pestilence did. This was a slow-moving plague, not a very fast-moving plague. It wasn't Omicron. It was very contagious. But it moved slowly from one place to another, which means that people with awareness of the plague could travel from one area to another and deliver news of what was going on without thoroughly infecting everybody they encounter, and the plague would arrive a month or two or three later. So communities had a chance to develop strategies about how to combat it. Now, bear in mind, we're not talking about Greisa Chachamim, who had, you know, PhDs in science from Harvard. We're talking about idiots. Okay, fine. We're talking about idiots. So which means, what is prepare, what is that going to connote? It's going to mean finding an anticipatory scapegoat. You know, it's a preemptive scapegoat. Oh, something bad is going to happen here? Well, let's take advantage of a situation that we know is going to develop. It's not already now, but it will be. Let's do something about it. Of course, that means that can mean and did mean attacking Jews. And Jews know it's coming. They have to somehow prepare themselves for the worst. Well, what are the Jews going to do?
Go somewhere else.
So go somewhere else is not much of a possibility, because where are you going to go? It's happening everywhere. So in the end, the Jews will go to Poland. Casimir the Great will invite them in. But in the short run, it's going to be seeking the protection of whatever sovereign had invited them into their current location, whether it's the bishop or the count or the duke or whatever, who under whose nominal protection they were living all along. Well, live up to your end of the bargain and protect us. Are they going to protect you? Well, maybe. Or maybe they'll believe all the shtusim, all the accusations. Remember, nobody knows why all these people are dying. And so the protector of the Jews may come to believe the worst, for lack of a better explanation. Okay.
So didn't you say last week that it was the clergy, as you just said, that protected, and the ones that were going out and killing the Jews were the rabble?
Okay, so
in
this case, it's the rabble, and in some instances, political officials or upstart political officials. On the whole, the church was pro-Jewish, especially the highest levels of the church. It was occasionally a bishop who was a bad actor, but for the most part, the church played this, you know, reasonably well. Okay, now, well poisonings was a charge that began in Franconia in 1319, predating the death, the Black Death by 3 decades. So the idea that you throw some poison in the well and kill people, it's not such a brilliant thing to concoct. I mean, it's a pretty easy thing to accuse somebody of, especially if evidence doesn't matter. And it happens a few decades before the Black Death, but it will come back with a vengeance during the Black Death. So in connection with the plague, well poisoning charge first arose in Switzerland in late 1348. Jews came to the Swiss lands in the 1250s. And so by the 1340s, they were pretty well entrenched, and there was a large community in the various Swiss cities. There was nothing too monstrous that you couldn't say about the Jews. So as much as the Jews were entrenched in society, you could say really nasty things about them, and people might believe it. Well, in what regard were Jews interacting with Christians at this phase of Christian civilization? It's two ways. One is money lending, which gives the Jews a shame ra, a bad name.
What about tax collection?
So tax collection was at an earlier time under the Holy Roman Empire, and then later in the Polish lands as tax collectors for the Poryts. At this time, less so. So one is money lending, which gives the Jews a shame ra. The other is medicine, which gives the Jews a shame tov, a good name. The Jews are well represented in the doctor profession. However, just as the Jewish doctor could use his medicinal herbs for a favorable purpose, so too he could use it for a nefarious purpose. So around the era of Stalin's death, you know, the doctor plot, 1952-53, the Jewish doctors are killing our political leaders, so the Jewish doctors are killing our population. That kind of argument can be made in 1348. The plot was supposedly originating in Toledo, Spain. Rabbi Pirate of Chambéry, Savoy, carried it out. That a Jew was tortured and confessed in southern France and admitted, yes, there's a scheme of the Jews to kill all of Christendom. And there's a concoction that they use to poison the well. What is in this concoction? Christian hearts, spiders, frogs, lizards, human flesh, and don't forget, sacred hosts. Desecration of the host. And a partridge in a pear tree, okay? Now, they pulverized it and made it into a powder. And this powder was poisonous and was distributed to Jewish communities all over Europe to ruin the drinking water. So, now come the pogroms. In Zurich, the Jews were burned on September 21st, 1348. This was followed, we're not exactly sure, but probably close to 100. Then in Augsburg, Würzburg, and in Munich. Judicial torture was the way in which information was extracted, if you want to call it information. And in the style of the time, it was known as, quote unquote, put to the question. They put you to the question. Now, they put you to the question under great duress, under a wheel. They would put you on a wheel and spin the wheel. And then if you could die from that, or they could break your bones in the process. So Jews under these conditions would admit to poisoning the springs, the wells, and even food. Which food item in particular was known for as part of this libel? Butter. Butter. Yeah. Balavini was the Jewish surgeon at Lake Geneva. He was arrested and tortured and confessed. And he claimed to get the poison from a Rabbi Jacob. The toxin came from a basilisk, which was some kind of a reptile or a mystical creature. Nobody knew exactly what. But then again, it didn't exist, so nobody had to know what.
That was mentioned in the Harry Potters.
I never read Harry Potter, so I don't know. Now, the powder was supposedly sprinkled over the water, like a little packet. You sprinkle it over the water. What color was the powder? Machlokas Rishonim. Some said it was white. Some said it was black, some said it was red, and some said it was green. It's not surprising there would be different theories, because after all, this didn't really exist.
Wouldn't it show a different color?
It didn't exist. You could say whatever you want, you know? Now, there were different theories, however, all were false. A Jew named Mumsen said that every Jew over a certain tender age knew the truth, making them all complicit. Now, this is an important point. If you're going to kill lots of Jews, they have to all be guilty. But if there's only a plot being hatched by a couple of people in some faraway place, then only they're guilty. So the convenient excuse is to say, well, this was a widely known conspiracy and that all the Jews knew about it And all the goyim didn't know about it until now. And now the goyim know about it. This is Protocols of the Elders of Zion kind of material, where you're now, if you're a Christian and you want to buy into this, you have to subscribe to the notion that for years and years and years, thousands and thousands of people, including relatively young children, knew a very important secret that had a tremendous impact on the fate of the world, and yet they all kept quiet until now.
Before this happened, were the Jews getting along with the Christians?
The answer is it depends where. Up through the 11th century, relations between Jews and Christians were not terrible. In the 12th century, things began to change. There were conversions in both directions. But in the 12th century, things really took a turn for the worse, starting with the First Crusade, continuing through the various blood libels. And by the 14th century, things were really bad. Jews were definitely otherized. They were a complete other. Okay. Well, there were misleading judicial proceedings in Switzerland. And this created an example to be followed in other European countries. So the Swiss did everybody a disservice here. There was a deep psychological need for some kind of a scapegoat, and they found it. It was the Jew. In January 1349, the Basel massacre occurred. 50 Jews were killed by burning a hut on an island in the Rhine River. The pogrom was not legally sanctioned by the bishop or the town council. So this was the mob, not the town council, not the bishop. The accusation was well poisoned. The killing happened even before the plague hit the city. So it was a preemptive strike. This was not, you poisoned our well, therefore we'll kill you. It was, we hear that Jews poison wells, and we know that people are going to soon die. So we'll kill you first.
Wasn't the hut especially built to burn?
Yes, food? Yes. So precursor to Auschwitz. Now, some Jews accepted baptism. Children were forcibly converted, and the remainder were killed. But the key point is, debts owed to Jews were erased, which is the key motivation for the whole process. Jews of Basel were killed on a Friday, in memory of Jesus, who was killed on a Friday. The fact that baptism saved you meant that the real crime was not well poisoning. The real crime was simply being Jewish. Basel Jews were formally expelled at the end of 1349. They returned to reconstitute the community in 1356 because Jews are necessary. Jews are necessary to be killed, and Jews are necessary to live. Okay, they needed money lenders. They needed an element of the economy that only Jews could fill. So, yeah, Jews came back. And they were in Basel from 1356 to 1397 and then gone for 400 years. Not to come back for a long, long time. But we had they got their comeuppance because the first Zionist Congress, Basel. Okay. Now, January 30th, 1349 was the Freiburg Massacre. Then Valentine's Day. February 14th, 1349, the Valentine's Day Massacre at Strasbourg. So what happened here? This was not simply a matter of well poisoning and black death and hostility to the Jews. There was a political fight that was simmering for a long time between various factions of the city. There was a revolt by the guilds 5 days earlier on February 9th, and political fighting undergirded the whole riots. Jews were accused of usury, well poisoning, desecration of the host, blood libel, every sin under the sun. Jews were tough in the money business, especially in Strasbourg, because they had to pay high taxes to the municipality for the right of protection. So Jews needed money, not because they were avaricious, but because without that money, they can't live here. So they were usurious and very, you know, very tough in that matter, but out of a desire for self-preservation, not for any real aggrandizement or enrichment. The leadership of Strasbourg feared the possibility of a spillover effect and the loss of their political power. The patrician bourgeoisie needed to protect the Jews, which was their legal responsibility and the key to their financial success. The artisans revolted against the master tradesmen. The guilds won and were ready to destroy the Jews. So basically, there's a clash of different economic interests. And the side that favored the Jews had formerly been in power, but they lost. And having lost, the Jews have no protectia, and it's curtains. Jews were led out to a hut to be burned alive. Those ready to be baptized and attractive women were kept alive. The bishop himself was indebted to Jews. And so he was especially motivated to see this occur. Strasbourg took legal measures to retain Jewish assets. Surviving Jews got nothing. 2,000 were killed. So this was a very bad episode, February 14th through about the 20th, 1349. The bishop was in cahoots. What? If you converted, you could live.
You gave your property up.
That's unclear.
But it seems from your discussion that the Black Plague has taken a backseat to all of this.
Yes. The Black Plague is simultaneous with all this, but not the real motivation behind anything. There's a pretext of, they poisoned the well. In some locations, that accusation is part of a package of accusations, but it's far from the real leading cause here. Once you're dying in large numbers in your community, you don't have time and koyach to start killing others. It's before you get hit with the plague that you have the koyach to kill others. So March 21st. Well, that's true, but you have to have the physical strength to do it. Now, March 21st, 1349. The Erfurt Massacre. The number of dead in Erfurt is uncertain. There are low estimates that said it was only 100. There are high estimates that say it was 3,000. Now, between 100 to 3,000 is a tremendous difference. I'm not sure exactly why there should be such a disparity. Some Jews burned themselves rather than be lynched. Erfurt suffered 16,000 deaths from the plague after the Jews were gone. So this is in Erfurt, Germany. After the Jews are already gone, 16,000 died of plague. None had died of plague prior to the massacres. So clearly, if there was ever an example that says this comes before this and therefore it's not a result of this, it's the example of the Erfurt Massacre. Alexander Suslin, the author of the Sefer HaAguda, one of the Rishonim, important Ashkenazic Rishonim, was among the victims of this massacre. Those of you who are familiar with Judaic studies know that there's a manuscript of the Tosefta called the Erfurt Manuscript, the Ayin. And Tosefta Kipshuta of Lieberman, Saul Lieberman, that's one of the main manuscripts. So how could there be a surviving manuscript of a Tosefta, it's the oldest one in the world, if this Jewish community was destroyed? The answer is, there was fire, and there was pillaging and bloodshed, but there was a lot of looting. And someone recognized the value of this manuscript, and it survived with bloodstains on it. It was owned by various church entities for the next few hundred years, and is today owned by the Berlin State Library. So the oldest copy of the Tosefta in the world is owned by the Berlin State Library as a result of a massacre in 1349. In 1998, the Erfurt treasure was discovered in a wall in an old dilapidated structure dating back to the 1340s. 1998, so 24 years ago, somebody stumbled upon a stash of coins and silver tableware worth a tremendous amount of money. Well, what happened? The answer is it belonged to a Jew, a money changer by the name of Kalman von Hia. And he was among those who died in the massacre. And it's available to look at in some museum now. Okay. Now, in the spring and summer of 1349... They know it is because there was some kind of a ledger that has name on it.
He has family claim it.
Who knows who's his family?
I'm sure somebody found it.
Someone can manufacture proof, yeah. Now, in the spring and summer of 1349, the persecutions continued in Frankfurt, in Köln, in Mainz, and in Worms. On August 22nd, Mainz Jewry was killed, 6,000 dead. But in the only instance in this whole Tkufa, this whole era, where the Jews fought back. So remember, this is a year into the persecutions. This is not one of the earlier ones. It's one of the later ones. The Jews recognize if we just lie down like a lamb, they're going to slaughter us. We'll fight back. 200 Gentiles were killed in the process. So the Jews lost because they didn't have the upper hand, but they took out 200 Christians in the process.
Did it stop it a little bit?
Probably not. Now, in Worms, the Jews committed collective suicide in the summer of 1349, rather than be lynched. The persecutions ended in the Rhineland. Rina's asking about the 1370 massacre in Brussels. Yes, we're going to get to that. So the persecutions ended in the Rhineland in late 1349. However, they continued in the Hanseatic cities of the Baltic coast and into parts of Eastern Europe into 1350 and 1351. When the killing was over, murders went unpunished. The killers, however, did not usually benefit from their acts of wanton destruction because the emperor took over ownership of the debts previously owed to Jews. Now, how could he do that? Well, the answer is he owned the Jews. The Jews were under his protection legally. So whatever was owed to them is owed to him.
Yeah, but how would he know? Who did the bookkeeping?
You know, Masha Kana Eved Kana Rabo, as we say in the Gemara. So, okay, so who did the bookkeeping? The answer is many of the debts were recorded in official offices. So it wasn't so simple to say, well, they don't exist anymore. They do exist. If, however, the paperwork was destroyed and there was no backup records in the officialdom's office, then yeah, then nobody knew. Then you could get away with the financial gain associated with your murderous actions. Okay, so the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles IV, was a bad guy. And he decreed that those Jews who were killed had forfeited their possessions. This gave Christian neighbors a very strong financial incentive to kill their neighbor, the Jewish neighbor, because now it was a hefkevelt. If it's there for the taking, you're going to take it. There were almost no Jews left in Germany and the Low Countries by the end of 1351. Now, there would be the communities would reconstitute themselves to an extent, but nowhere near what they had been in the prior centuries, and that the centers of Judaism would move eastward. Okay, so the official church. Okay, eventually German Jewry would grow in size, but it would take a while, take a long while. The official church position was pro-Jewish. Papal pronouncements by Clement VI and Innocent VI favored preservation of Jewish rights and denied the legitimacy of the well poisoning accusations. Pope Clement VI. We're going to see why it meant nothing. There's a reason why. So Pope Clement VI issued a papal bull against the well poisoning. And I'll read to you not the whole thing, but the key parts. So listen, pay careful attention. This is direct quotation from the papal bull of 1348. While we can rightly hate the treachery of the Jews, who preserving in their stubbornness, do not care to understand the words of the prophets and the secrets of their writings and join the new Christian faith, but we're aware that our Savior worthy to choose the Jewish tradition in which for the salvation of the human race, he took a mortal flesh. For this reason, it is normal that we cherish these same Jews because of the humanity. So stop right there. In one sentence, he did this and he did that. He was in here and he was there. In other words, the Jews, they're terrible. They don't bother to learn the true meaning of the Bible. They rejected Jesus. Blah, blah, blah. But on the other hand, you know, Jesus, we venerate as the deity. Well, he chose to come down to earth to save all of humanity. And of all the people he chose to come down to the earth as part of, he chose the Jews. So, you know, we got to like the Jews a little bit. Because after all, Jesus chose the Jews. So they're terrible, but, you know, they have something going for them. Then, as they seek help, our protection and mercy of Christian piety, in other words, they're turning to us. They're desperate. There are people out to kill them. And the only way they survive is if we give them a little Christian piety. We give them a little rachmonis. We, following the footsteps of Calix, Eugene, Alexander, Clement, Celestine, and Innocent, Gregor, Nicholas, blah, 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 okay, and our Roman pontiff predecessors of happy memory. So he quotes all the popes who were before him. We give them the shield of our protection, ordering, among other things, that no Christian can in no way cause injury or death to these Jews without receiving the judgment of the Lord or an official of the land and region in which they live. So you can't kill a Jew with impunity. There's a law. There's law and order. And if you kill Jews, you could be got punished. They should not take their money from them or require compulsory service. You can't rob the Jew. You can't enslave the Jew, except for the things that in ancient times they were used to doing. And that if someone, although knowing the content of such decree, attempts to act against him, he endangers his title and office. He must be struck by a final sentence of excommunication, unless he takes care to correct his presumption by a worthy satisfaction. Basically, if you violate my order, you're going to put you in chayrim. If you're a goy and you persecute the Jews too much, I'll put you in chayim, he says. Then, however, recently a public outcry, or more accurately, a rumor nasty, came to our attention that some Christians mistakenly blame the plague, which God afflicts the Christian people, caused by the sins of the people, come from poisons Jews received by the devil, who in their own impious temerity killed some of these Jews, regardless of age or gender. And although these Jews were ready to submit to the judgment of a court competent, even if the attacks of the Christians had not been calmed by it, so on and so on and so forth. Okay, so basically he says like this. There's a rumor flowing around that all the people who are dying because the Jews poisoned the wells. Well, he says it simply isn't true. And if you try to continue doing this, you're violating an apostolic order. This is the Pope. The key line is this. This is the key line. Throughout many parts of the world, the same plague, by hidden judgment of God, has afflicted and afflicts the Jews themselves and many other races who have never lived alongside them. So number one, the Jews are dying too. So don't say they killed the Goyim because, after all, the Goyim died and the Jews lived. Wrong. The Jews also died. And secondly, there are Gentiles dying in parts of the world where there are no Jews. So how could you blame them for poisoning the well? They aren't even there. So the whole accusation is bunk. So says the Pope. Well, very nice. But why is it that the papal bull of this era did not carry the kind of oomph that it should have? Well, there's an answer. Part of that answer is, also the Clement said that those who were accusing Jews of poisoning the well are seduced by that liar, the devil. The devil is seducing you to level anti-Semitic accusations against the Jews. And he criticized the flagellants for shedding the blood of Jews. Who are the flagellants?
Listen, I would think people who wore hair shirts and they...
Good. So those who do makas on themselves, they smack themselves as part of a self-mortification, as a means of atonement, of kapara. So they were very popular in the mid-14th century, and they were among the most pious of all the Christian, real wackos, and they were among the key figures in spreading the well poisoning rumors. And so he says, you flagellants, who the Pope didn't like to begin with, because he thought that self-mortification was a bit extreme and was, you know, not good for the interest of the church, but you guys are taking it too far with the Jews also. So cut it out. Now, why are people not listening to the Pope? The answer is, where is the Pope?
Rome.
So the Pope is not in Rome.
Constantinople.
The Pope is not in Constantinople. Where is the Pope? Who's of
near Provence or
Avignon? The Pope is in Avignon.
Is there three popes?
So there were seven popes in Avignon during the Babylonian captivity, the Gullus Babel. The Babylonian captivity of the Jewish people was 70 years after the Nebuchadnezzar. So too the popes were out of Rome in Avignon for about 70 years, between 1307 or 1309 and 1376 or something. They're about 1377. Okay. Then after 1377, there was the Western Schism, where there were anti-popes in Avignon and other places, but the real pope, or it was decided later on these were the real popes, were back in Rome at the Vatican. So for about 100 years or more, there's a lack of consensus about the authority of any particular figure who is the pope. And so whatever he says about what's going on, especially popular things like killing Jews, well, his say-so is not going to carry that same kind of weight. Okay. In total, there were 60 large Jewish communities destroyed and 150 lesser-sized communities that were destroyed. 400 communities were targeted with pogroms of greater or lesser intensity. Now, what was that? It's hard to know, Sach HaKol, altogether, how many Jews were killed in the pogroms associated with the Black Death, but my guess is it was no less than 15,000, probably significantly more than that. Probably upwards of 30 or 40,000.
Huh?
Well, a community might be 10 people. It might be 20 people. Okay, so Some deny that Jews had any greater rate of survival due to sanitary practices. So all that stuff about Netilas Yadayim and Mikvah and Rechitzas Yadayim Raglayim for Shabbos, more recent contemporary scholarship is dismissive of all of that and says, it didn't make a difference. The bottom line is people got sick and they died regardless of their behaviors and regardless of their religious identity. And as for the thinking that Jews died in a lesser ratio, well, people were confused. And it's not as though they were capable of calculating accurately anyway. All this stuff is post facto, looking back and trying to guess the numbers. But in the moment, did anybody really know the numbers? Probably not. This was not a turning point. This was not the first, nor was it the last of the persecutions. As was mentioned in the chat, in 1370, just 20 years later, there's the Brussels Massacre, which was a very significant massacre. A lot of people died. And that was a desecration of the host episode. Not so much a well-poisoning episode, but a desecration episode. Now, new research. Were there politicians who protected the Jews? The answer is some. The Duke of Austria, for example, protected the Jews. And so in the Austrian realms, you didn't have Black Death era pogroms of any scale. These happened in other places, in the Rhineland. They had it everywhere. But pogroms connected to it did not happen there. New research suggests that well poisonings had little to do with the pogroms. What were the motivating factors? Well, number one, religious fanaticism, which we've already seen in the prior classes, connected to the host, the blood libel, the ritual murder charges. When you really think Jews are terrible and you think the church is the be-all and end-all, you'll say bad things about the enemies of the church and think you're doing a mitzvah in the process. The fact that people are dying the Black Death, maybe they're a convenient cover story, but not really related. Secondly, financial. This was an opportunity to steal money, to erase debts, to grab possessions. And yeah, the Black Death could be a cover story, but you just want the stuff. And thirdly, political. Jews played a certain role in society, were allied with the existing administration in certain principalities. And if you wanted to unseat those current reigning interests, one of the ways to do it was take out their ally, kill the Jew. So a counter argument, however, is that the Black Death did intensify the need to blame an outside group. And that while other factors can always be found to harm Jews, the particular persecution did truly relate to the mass deaths of the broader population. I tend to think that it was inevitable in a time of mass death that the Jews would be accused of something. And that even if the pogrom in any given city happens before the plague hits that city, but they know it has affected other cities, it would be unreasonable to think that the churchmen of that era would forego an opportunity like this to carry out vengeance against their foes.
In California, with the anti-vax, the blue star. Yeah.
Okay, so now, in the chat, who's writing in the chat? Let me see who that is. There was a reference to... Okay, so Rina's saying it's a pulmonary form pneumonic plague. Correct. So who knew that? The answer is the Pope had a doctor. The Pope's personal physician, Clement VI's personal physician, was aware that there was a distinction between two different types of the plague, that there was whatever bubonic, and there was also the pulmonary form. And I don't know how he knew this 700 years ago, but clearly his scientific knowledge had developed in such a way that he was able to distinguish between these various forms. And that's also how he was able to convince the Pope that the accusation of well poisoning was false. How do you know it's false? Maybe the Jews really are doing these things. And the answer is that his doctor was able to make him aware and convinced that it wasn't because of that, and he had some kind of accurate scientific knowledge. Okay, now the last point for tonight is what happened to the Jews after all this was over. The Black Death helped push Ashkenazi Jewry into Eastern Europe, further east and further north. The Jews were welcomed in Poland by Casimir the Great, keeping up a tradition which had already been established by Boleslav the Pious back in 1264. So Jews are moving to the Polish, the Lithuanian kingdom. And where are they no longer going to be? So all Christianity is Catholic except for that which is Eastern and therefore so-called Orthodox. It's going to take until after the Luther Revolution, Reformation, to have alternatives. But yeah, the Jews are going to be in a Catholic environment, although the further northeast you go, the less the Roman Church will have real control over religion in that sphere. Yeah, Poland is Catholic, but back then it was newly Catholic. So the Vatican is not as powerful as it would be at a later time. They had political rulers. They were not a theocracy. So the Jews are moving to points further north and further east. Where are Jews not going to be? Well, the answer is they're not going to be in those countries where they had already been expelled. Where had they been expelled from? England, most of France, and eventually parts of Germany, and eventually Spain. So next week, what I want to do is examine the map of Europe and see how anti-Semitic feeling leads to Jewish mobility. Jews are on the move, on the run sometimes, because there are a lot of places where you just can't go. Now, just because you can't go there doesn't mean you're not going to go there. Sometimes Jews violate these edicts, and not every expulsion order was adhered to as strictly as others. You know, were there Jews in France before Jews were formally allowed back into France in the French Revolution? Of course there were. Jews were emancipated because they were there. Well, how'd they get there? The answer is they violated whatever rules but prohibited them from being there. So not every expulsion really means an expulsion. But where did they happen? Why did they happen? And what are the solutions? You know, if you have to uproot yourself, you're going to go somewhere. Well, why do you choose to go to one place over another? The place, the safe havens, the places of refuge are not few and far between. There are plenty of them. But why do they exist and where are they? So that's going to be next week's presentation. Questions?
I have a question.
Of course, Tina.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Okay. How come the notion of conversos never developed then?
So the question is, why did the idea of conversos not develop at a time like the Black Death, or even earlier with blood libels? So there's a very simple answer, and that is when there aren't that many such individuals, then their apostasy is seen very unfavorably by the remaining Jewish community. And so sometimes those people, if they don't quickly try to revert back to their faith, are then shunned and are lost. It's a sad story, but that's what happens. Sometimes, through political pressure, it is possible to extract a concession from the authorities and that would allow these people who had a coerced baptism to revert back to their faith. And we did find, in certain instances during the Crusader period, that occurred, that they were allowed back. But you had to bribe the officials with a whole lot of money to make that happen. And it implicates whole questions about, from the Catholic point of view, is that even halakhically acceptable in their religion to allow a Jew back to Judaism? So that's why there were very few, and they could not sustain subterranean Judaism for any long stretch. But when in Spain and the Spanish possessions, where there were a whole lot of them, the subterranean Judaism was possible. And so it did exist in greater or lesser form. Sometimes people didn't even realize what they were doing. That's the basic answer.
Uh-huh. Oh, another question. And I know this sounds like bordering on apostasy, you know?
Let's hope it only borders on apostasy.
Borders on apostasy, but I don't know. I mean, the rabbis could not make an exception of life, to preserve life and allow for this baptism, which is really, most of the people would not believe in it anyway.
So the answer to that is the question is why did the Chazal not establish certain loopholes to allow for accepting baptism under duress to save your life? The answer is that they did water down the law to an extent, in that the three cardinal sins, one of which is idolatry, avodah zarah, is yahareg v'al yahavor, martyr yourself rather than commit the transgression. But it's not a capital crime to violate that rule, meaning that's the rule, and we in theory are hoping for your martyrdom in that situation so as to do a Kiddush Hashem instead of a Chilul Hashem. But let's say you choose the Chilul Hashem rather than the Kiddush Hashem, you have not committed a capital offense. You've just been coerced into doing something, and we're disappointed in your behavior. So does that mean that you should take the easy way out? There was a minority opinion within the Rishonim that says, yeah, you could. Now, certainly with Islam, that's what many, many Jews did, the Rambam included, because it was seen as being not idolatrous. It was monotheistic and therefore okay. But the Catholic Church was seen by almost all the rabbinical authorities as being truly idolatrous because of graven images and the like, and a Trinitarian doctrine. And so, it was the real avodah zarah. But an awareness that not everybody's up to the challenge. And if you failed and you stumbled, but you wanted back into Judaism and you were able to get back into Judaism, you could get back in.
Okay. So it leads me to believe, okay, that there's a hell of a lot of Jewish blood in this world.
Yeah. Yes, a lot of Jewish blood in this world.
That people half
of Russia is a quarter Jewish, or a quarter of Russia is half Jewish. Something like that. Now, in the chat, I see Dr. Haft has a question. Were there any individuals in authority who realized that the vast conspiracy theory could not be possible? Also, that the testimonies were inconsistent? Yes. So there was definitely an awareness by the higher level figures, both ecclesiastical and temporal, that well-poisoning theories were false. Were there some churchmen and some political leaders who thought that it was true? Yeah, probably there were some. But the vast bulk understood that this was baloney and that was being used as a pretext by the mob to do their worst. So the question is, who's going to speak up and say anything? The answer is the popes, but to little effect. Who else could have said something that would have made a difference? Well, the answer is in any given jurisdiction, if the local, gunslinger, the guy with the weapons decided, I'm not going to let this happen because it's based upon a falsehood. Yeah, sure, Jews could have been saved in that jurisdiction. And it probably did happen in some places that it was declared, well, this is false. We can't let this happen. But in other places where those intent on violence and mayhem had their way, they had their way. So certainly the case that people understood, high-level people, that vast conspiracy theories were just that. They were not true.
But you also said that there was no punishment. Even if they thought it wasn't true, what did it matter if nobody was going to
be right? Punished? So as Norman says, what does it matter if there's no punishment? It's true. If you're not going to get punished and it's profitable to do this, people are going to do it without much hesitation. Okay, we'll stop here. See you all next week.
One more question.
Yeah, sure.
All right. So the question is, you seem to indicate that the papacy was weak, right?
Yeah, well, for part of the time, yeah.
Okay, so the time of the Spanish Inquisition, was it still weak?
No, it was much stronger at that time.
What to say to Ferdinand and Isabella stopped?
It was much stronger in the 1480s and 90s than it was in the 1350s and 60s.
Could you repeat the question?
Was the papacy stronger at a later time in the days of the Spanish Inquisition? The answer is absolutely yes.
So why did they stop them?
I don't know. And I'm not sure that the papacy would have been able to stop them. But then again, the papacy didn't stop the expulsions from other Western European countries. Monarchs were given the ability to control their borders and who could live in their borders. And the expulsion of a Jewish community was not the worst offense. Okay, after all, you let them live. The Augustinian doctrine lives on because the Jew lives on somewhere else, but he lives on. Okay, we'll stop here.